From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The documentary film The Square is an intimate portrait of the chaotic uprising known as the Arab Spring in 2011. It's built around Tahrir Square in Cairo, the setting for the Egyptian Revolution and a powerful symbol of activism. But the square is not just about the particulars of this revolution, but any revolution. It traces the early days of elation and idealism that give way to questions about motivation and politics. There are sectarian divisions and disputes over tactics in the matter of vengeance and violence. Today in the program, we're profiling the square. The director, Jahan Nujain, will join us to talk about making this film and what she learned about the culture of revolution. After the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In Jahan Nujain's documentary film, The Square, there are a number of remarkable characters. The Egyptian revolutionaries sparked this Arab Spring protests, of course, in 2011. But the most compelling of them is Ahmed Hassan. It's like he's the voice, the conscience of the film. At one point in those early days of fervor and idealism, Ahmed describes his fellow protesters as exact copies of each other. And he says, without realizing it, these people found each other. There was no such thing, he said, as Christian or Muslim. They were one hand. But of course, after the adrenaline wears off, it becomes clear this revolution, or any revolution really, is more complicated than that. And the film explores the nature of an uprising, from the idealism of those early days to the conflicting motivations and interests. And of course, there's that constant struggle by Egyptian young people to stay unified through all of this. The part that is remarkable about the film is the story of how Jahan Nujain chronicled this story. To capture it, she spent more than 20 months camping out in Tahrir Square, and she had to follow her characters into the street. She herself was detained in the city's Tora prison for some 36 hours. The film premiered at this year's Sundance Film Festival. We're going to be screening it next Wednesday. We'll give you details about that as we go along. Jahan Nujain has worked on documentaries in the Middle East and the United States. Her 2004 film, Control Room, explored the difference in Arab and Western media coverage during the U.S. war in Iraq. And she's joining us today from NPR West in Culver City, California. And Jahan Nujain, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I wanted to ask you how you were thinking about this film in the earliest days, because I'm expecting that it became something different as you went along, of course, as it always does. But did you anticipate early on that the film would follow the ups and downs of a revolution like it had, or did you think it would be a more simple story in some ways at first?
Well, at the beginning, when Mubarak stepped down after 18 days, that was sort of where everybody said, okay, well, there's the story. You got the story. It's done. All of the news cameras and the international news cameras left the square. But there were a few sort of hardcore activists that stayed in the square and said, no, this is just the tip of the iceberg. This is the very beginning. Just because Mubarak has stepped down, the secret police is still in power. The regime is still in power. The rest of his government is in power. So we need to keep fighting until the deep state is removed and changed. And when I started talking to these people, and these are the people that you meet in the film, Ahmed, Khalid, Magdi, you realized that this was a long journey. Filmmaking-wise, it was a big challenge because how do you start a film with a climax? Where do you go from there? But we just decided we were going to stay in the square and see what happened and followed our characters. It was an incredible energy when I was there. And this is what I wanted to communicate to people. You have to understand that I grew up in Egypt where people weren't talking about politics, and people weren't, people were scared to talk about politics. Mm-hmm. If you asked somebody, what do you think about the current president? if it was a cab driver or somebody. The person didn't know who they were speaking to. They were afraid of arrest. They were afraid of really giving their true opinion. So when things exploded in Tahrir and you saw men and women and Christian, Muslim, all different classes speaking with each other and having this excitement about their future, it was incredibly inspiring. And then when the army started to come down on people after Mubarak stepped down, the people in the square basically said, you know, you can't take what we fought for away from us.
Right.
I had this one conversation with a cab driver who said, look, it's either you take me or you take me and my kids and my grandkids and my grandkids' kids. So it's better that you just take me. So that was the attitude there, and I wanted to be able to try to capture that and what it felt like to be in the middle of that.
Did you realize in the earlier days that it was and this is maybe something that I got from it as much as anything, was this idea that this is about the nature of any revolution, that you've got these highs and these incredible lows, and you've got these disputes, and then you have these moments when you wonder where violence is going to play and you question people's motives. I mean, do you think there is a broader sort of message there, a broader theme there about this is how it happens, or it has happened in the past when people protest?
Definitely. We don't feel like this film is just about Egyptian politics. Yeah. We feel like this film is important viewing for anybody who is involved in activism wherever you are in the world. Actually, one of our most exciting screenings was in Utah at one of the colleges, and people came up to us afterwards and said, these kids felt alive. These people felt so connected to their country and the fact that they could change it. And sometimes it feels in the States like we feel so distant and unable to change what's happening. And so to see people that are willing to put their lives on the line to fight for what they believe in, I think was incredibly inspiring. The other thing is, I was always interested in this concept of taking over a piece of land. You have squares all around the world. Mm. And here, these kids basically said, we're sitting in this square, Tahrir Square, the middle of Cairo, where, some hugely important government buildings are around it. And we're just going to sit here and not leave. And it was a place, it became sort of the conscience of the country. So whoever had control over that square was reaching media and getting their message out there. And that can exist anywhere in the world. I think also I was very interested in seeing how the ups and downs of a revolution and activism, because, you know, nobody ever sees the Martin Luther King or the Gandhi when their wife has left them and they have no place to go and they're lonely and they feel like they've lost the battle. But the most important part in that decision making is when they are completely alone and they do feel like they've failed, they go back the next day. And they keep fighting. And that was interesting to follow, because that really showed what a process this is, that you cannot determine the success or failure of a movement or a revolution based on one particular event, but it's the staying power and the fight that people have inside them that they're not going to give up.
Mm. I want to talk about January 25th, 2011. And this is when everyone gathers for the first time. And this is an important point. And there's a moment early on when Ahmed Hassan is talking. Before we talk about it, I want to ask about, because I want to talk about some of these different characters. Ahmed Hassan is, I don't know, I saw him in some ways the conscience of the film in some way. I mentioned it earlier. He's a remarkably charismatic voice, and he's such a profound character. Talk about finding him and the role that he plays in the film.
I think that's right on that you describe him as the conscience of the revolution. I met Ahmed, and why do you choose a character to follow? You choose them because they make you laugh, they surprise you, and you just want to spend time with them. You want to hang out with them, because making these films requires, you know, often 2-3 years of spending time with somebody. So you'd better like them. You have to feel like they're teaching you something. And Ahmed just leaps out. When the camera loves him, people love him, and he's able to have arguments and discussions with people somehow where he'll be speaking to one or two people, and in 10 minutes, you'll have 60 people crowded around him. Yeah. He really was this incredible person to follow because he was able to start conversations in the square that actually went someplace, that didn't deteriorate into just arguments, because he managed to pull different sides in and different opinions in. And so he became this very interesting character to follow that way. And you see him grow up in the film. At the beginning, yeah, he really looks like a boy. And by the end of the film, he looks like a grown adult. And for somebody, people marvel at the fact that, you know, this kid sold lemons in the street, and he's speaking like, you know, a philosopher that you would read in college, yeah, by the end of the film.
Yeah. I want to play a clip. Now, this is Ahmed speaking, and it's in Egyptian, but I wanted to give people a sense of his voice. And this is a moment, Jahan Nujaim, maybe you can mention, it's this, early on he's appealing to a friend. He calls him Mohammed, a friend on the phone, telling him, and this is the sense early on, to come to the square. You know, for your sake, he says, for your kid's sake, for the family. And it's such a call to sort of call, not call to arms, I suppose, but a call to get together. Let me play this clip from the film, The Square. Again, it's in Egyptian, but you get a sense of just his passion there. You want to talk about that scene, because this is in the earliest days, and when you really have no sense of exactly how it's going to play out.
He's saying, you know, basically, come down to the square, tell all your friends, this is for your family, this is for your future. And his friend on the phone is saying, well, aren't you afraid of your life? I've been watching, you know, and of course, state TV was saying, go home and... you know, don't go down to the square. It's a bunch of, you know, thugs and hooligans in the square. But he says back to him, no, this is about changing our future. And it's this incredibly powerful moment because, again, he felt like unless people could come down in vast numbers, they wouldn't be able to change anything. Because what happened was the army, you know, the police and the people fought, and the police actually couldn't manage the situation because there were too many people.
Yeah.
And then the army came down. And for a long time during those early days, people didn't know whether the army was going to shoot on the people and side with Mubarak, or whether they were going to, you know, side with the people.
Mm-hmm.
And what's said now is that ultimately there were too many people in the streets, there were too many people in squares across Egypt for the army to be able to shoot on the people. It would have been a complete massacre if they had. And so they basically turned around to Mubarak and said that it was time for Mubarak to step down. However, what becomes very interesting is the role that the army takes afterwards,
right?
Because instead of handing over power to a civilian government, they maintain power. And that's when our activists that we follow in the film stay in the square and say, hold on a minute, this is not what we fought for.
In those early days, you get a sense pretty early on, and it's another theme in the film, of the importance of these images on the internet, and the, you know, you see the constant glow from people's cameras as they're capturing these images when they're in the street. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about that, because this is the idea that Ahmed says is going to the street sort of broke the fears of the people in Egypt. And as you said, they were afraid to talk about it. But it seems like in some ways the openness of the internet and this sort of new idea, this new aspect of the media seem to be another dynamic that plays out in this story. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, I think that's right. It was this explosion of basically, we are not going to be afraid anymore, and we are going to share this message with it as widely as we can. And that included taking everybody having their camera phones in the square and uploading footage to YouTube, which would then be spread around by people because nothing was being shown on the state television. And it included putting graffiti everywhere. I mean, graffiti exploded across the streets of Cairo. Mm. So somebody would get killed and, you know, that night there would be a stencil made of their face, and that stencil of that person's face would explode across the streets of downtown Cairo. So you would see an army guy standing there, and behind him would be 10 images of this guy that the army had killed the day before. It was basically saying, you are not going to ignore this anymore. We're not going to just put a blanket over our eyes anymore about this. And people used social media and the internet as a tool of the revolution. So, for example, Khalid, one of our characters, mm-hmm. starts an organization called Musirin, where very early on he starts collecting images from people from their camera phones. They were giving him USBs, and he's started collecting these images which were showing what was actually happening on the ground. And he says, you know, we don't know exactly what we're filming and what will be able to be used as mm-hmm. evidence as a later point, but it's just important that we keep capturing this. And at a certain point in the revolution, in sort of the height of the battle, this internet site that he started called Musirin mm-hmm. became the highest watch YouTube site in the entire world at that point. So it was really affecting people, obviously. It was being shared. And it got to a point where the news networks could not avoid picking up these images because they were being seen so widely online. Once they picked up the images, people in their homes started seeing it, people who weren't so involved in the revolution, and they were outraged. One image specifically of which you see in the film,
yeah.
of a body being dragged by a policeman across the square and thrown into the garbage can, got uploaded on YouTube, spread widely around, picked up by the television stations, and people that I knew who were not involved in the revolution at all were calling me and saying, this can't be happening right. in our country. And that caused people to flock down to the square in the hundreds of thousands and caused the violence to stop. So it was incredible to see how one person with a camera taking an image of a body being dragged across the street, uploaded onto YouTube, spread widely, picked up by the news networks, causing people to flock down to the streets to basically say, this is not happening under my watch, caused the violence to start to stop, and a wall was actually built between the revolutionaries in the square and the police headquarters, which was on a couple minutes away.
Well, let's talk about Khalid Abdallah. He's the one who's mentioning the battle, he says, is in the images. The battle are in these stories, the one who talks about the media. He's an Egyptian actor. He lived outside of Egypt for a number of years, but he's come back, and he plays an important role in the film and really in the uprising. Talk about him as a character.
Well, Khalid I met through Cressida, his wife, who was his girlfriend at the time, and we met in the square. We met everybody you see in the film, we met during the first 2 weeks of the revolution.
Wow.
And I started speaking to Cressida, and she said, with great admiration, you know, my boyfriend knows a lot about what's going on. He comes from a long line of political activism. And his father was an activist and is in exile in London, and his grandfather was an activist who was also jailed. So he's an actor. He was the star of The Kite Runner. He was in Green Zone. And he basically left his acting life, put it on hold for 2 years to come and be in the square and be a part of this revolution. But aside from being an incredible actor, he was somebody who was incredibly articulate about what was going on during times which were very confusing. Mm. And I think that probably comes from having grown up, you know, at the dinner table. This was the conversation, the future of Egypt and what was happening, and growing up with that, he probably had a very deep understanding of what was happening that was, you know, that not everybody had. So we started following him mm-hmm. because we would go to him during times which were very confusing and ask him what was going on, and he would often make things clear that were very unclear. And Cressida, his now wife, actually became part of our film team. So I don't know whether he ever expected that would happen, that he would be waking up every morning with a camera in his face, but it made for some very intimate filming because Cressida filmed a lot of the footage of Khalid in the film, and they ultimately got married and are living in Cairo.
Huh. It's an interesting contrast between Khaled and Ahmed, because Ahmed is so full of bluster and confidence, and Khaled is too in some ways, but we also see him engaging in these conversations, seeing what's playing out on the news media, having these Skype conversations with his father, where you see this sense of doubt, where he seems uncertain. And it's an interesting contrast between him and Ahmed. Ahmed always seems, he can be demoralized, Ahmed, but he always seemed kind of certain. And so, I don't know, I thought that was an interesting contrast in those characters.
I think both of them do share, what they both share is a kind of principledness about them. Mm-hmm. They are so driven by their principles in a way that was just inspiring and admirable. I mean, I came to the square after living in New York and after marching against the Iraq War. And, you know, the U.S. is a place that the entire world looks to the U.S. in the 60s and what happened in the civil rights movement and our ability to change things by, you know, people power. And yet, before the Iraq War, it was as if we were not able to do anything. Nothing changed. The fact that so many people poured down to the streets. So I had a kind of cynicism when I went to Cairo, when I stood in the square. I thought, oh my God, this is going to be a disaster. People are going to be mowed down by tanks. People are going to be cleared. And so to see these kinds of people like Khaled and Ahmed and get to know them and hear that and feel their deep, deep attachment to what they believed they could do to change the country. And there was just no doubting on either of their sides, actually, that they could change things. I mean, there's moments of depression and there's mm-hmm. moments of, you know, frustration, but they keep coming back. And that's what's important to see.
Shahan Nujaim is with us. She directed The Square. This coming Wednesday evening, we're presenting a free screening of the film at 7 o'clock at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. It's part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Nujaim and producer Karim Amer will join us via Skype for a Q&A. It's all going to be on our website, the details anyway, radiowest.kuer.org. We need to take a brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we continue our documentary series, Through the Lens. We're talking about the film The Square, built around Tahrir Square, which was the setting for the revolution in Egypt, but it's also a profound symbol in the film. The director, Shahan Nujaim, is joining us to take us through the layers of this story, from the elation in those early days to the conflicting motivations and interests, and all about this constant struggle by these Egyptian young people to keep unified through all of this. We're going to be screening the film next Wednesday. We'll give you the details about that. Shahan Nujaim is joining us from NPR West in Culver City. I want to ask, there's a moment, we see a few figures from the military, a kind of charismatic spokesman for the military, general,
Bahit.
Yeah, he's kind of a fascinating character. But then we also see, and I wanted to ask about this moment, Major Haitham. He kind of raises this question that you get, I think, among some in Egypt probably at the time, people questioning the motives of these young people. And let me play a little, again, it's an Egyptian, so I'll just play just a moment of it, but I want to give you a sense of this soldier, because he starts raising these questions about whether or not the protesters were there just to pose, you know, if they had taken on the mantle of protest, if they were really that sincere, you know, that sincere. Here's another just brief moment from the square. Talk about this part of the film, that sense of doubt. He's awfully smug and awfully sure of himself, this major. We see him a couple of times in the film. Say something about mm-hmm. him, if you would.
Major Haitham was somebody that actually Ahmed filmed a lot of. When Ahmed at a certain point picks up a camera, he starts you know, we were filming the general, and the general couldn't be filmed at a certain point in time, and this was the general's driver. And so he's an interesting perspective, because he's a perspective of somebody who, you know, never actually went to Tahrir Square, but got all of his information from state television. So when we asked him, and this was only revealed at the end, you know, he had all of these very strong opinions of the people in the square, and we asked him at the end, well, have you ever been to the square? And at the end he said, no, of course not. I've never gone to the square. I just see this stuff on television, you know. So he was basically a mouthpiece, I felt, for what a lot of the people were feeling when they just watched what state TV was saying. And what state TV was saying was, these are a bunch of thugs, they're a bunch of, you know, they're paid by foreigners. It was an attempt to really discredit the people in the square. And, you know, that's possible to do in any sort of people's movement, right? Because you do have the people in the square, and then you do have people that that, you know, it's very difficult to control who is in a public square. So it's very easy it's a very easy place to manipulate. But he, for me, was this voice of kind of the people that are sitting on their couch watching TV, or the sort of military establishment, and what they were thinking of these sort of hooligans in the square.
Yeah. You know, Khaled Abdallah mentions something I wanted to ask about, and this was one of the things that I thought was really nice about the film, is you get a sense of what that place was like. I mean, Khaled talks about the kind of infrastructure that goes on in the square. You know, they house themselves, they have a kind of a security system, and we see people playing soccer, and we see people getting haircuts, and we see people putting up flags and decorating the place. What was it like to be there from day to day? I mean, it took on a life of its own, that place.
It did. It was, and it was different at different times. I mean, there were the times when we, you know, and I say we because, I mean, I became a real part of it, and our cameras became a part of it. We had 5 cameras in the square off and on during the last 20 months. But it was amazing. It was, you know, it was incredible to see people and how they could create a place to live for, you know, days on end. You know, electricity would be taken from the street lamps and wired down, and, you know, you'd have people plugging their cell phones in on a strip coming from electricity from the street lamps and electricity from the lamp from the metro sign. People would make, you know, food, and different people would bring food and soup to feed people. And there was a whole security system that was set up. I mean, Ahmed actually set up the first security system of the square, where different people had, you know, badges, and basically people would stand and pat people down to make sure that there were no weapons, and that to keep the square a safe place to be. So it was really incredible to see this kind of, you know, little mini village being formed.
As we're sort of tracing the ups and downs of this story, conflicts begin, you know, with the military. Military loses patience. They start to impose these curfews. And we start to see in some of the scenes from the square the interaction between the military and the protesters. And at first, you hear from the military, we're here to protect you, we're with you, we salute you. And then you start to hear these kind of veiled threats, and you start to see these direct threats. And things really begin to break down. And then there's this moment, this scene in the middle of the night, where people are just kind of waiting for something to happen, you know, waiting for the military to arrive, and it's really tense. And sure enough, of course, it happens. Will you talk about that moment?
Well, the square was the clearings of the square were could happen at any moment, and it was often a complete surprise. So, you know, sometimes there would be these threats, and you wouldn't know whether these threats were for real or not. So there was this sort of nervousness that you see among people. But, you know, there were two really big clearings that happened before the sort of what I'll call the Masbiro massacre, which happens a bit later on in the film. And those two major clearings happened in March and in April. And during the March clearing, it just came out of nowhere, and thugs were used. So the army came in and used a lot of plain-clothed sort of hired thugs to use sticks to break down the tents, and this entire village that we were just describing was completely, like, you know, broken down with sticks or whatever they had. People were chased out. Gunshots were fired in the air. Nobody was actually killed, but people were just completely cleared. The square was flooded with water. They flooded the square with water so that nobody could come back into it. And what came out of that was that, and this is when I really realized that we had a film that we had and a story we had to tell. What came out of that first clearing was that Rami Assam, the singer of the revolution, was arrested and dragged to the Egyptian Museum with a number of other people and tortured, badly tortured. Right. And I posted these images when these images came out, and Ida, one of the people in our film, filmed him. I posted some of these images on my Facebook, and I had friends, smart friends of mine, looking at my Facebook and saying, there is absolutely no way that the military did this. No way. This is makeup. This is made up. There's no way. And that's when I, you know, felt like there's this narrative that's being constructed on state television that many intelligent people across Egypt are watching and believing, and there's a whole nother story that is happening here that nobody is talking about. And you know, when you see that, that's when this, you feel sort of an anger and a need to get this other story out there, and that's where I really felt like, you know, we had a film that we had to make. Because literally 2 weeks before, Rami was being heralded on, you know, CNN, on television stations as, you know, the singer of the revolution that has turned the chants of the revolution into the songs of the revolution. He's this handsome guy that, you know, everybody was saying, you know, here's this Egyptian that people should look up to. And then he's badly tortured in the Egyptian Museum 3 weeks later.
Yeah.
And there's a complete media blackout on it. Nobody was talking about it. So that's really where we felt like we had to continue filming.
I wanted to ask you about the experience you had being arrested. Someone spots
which time?
Yeah, which the time when you were sent to prison, I guess, is the time. I mean, there were a number of times when you and your crew were detained. And we see, this is interesting though. We see moments of that, or at least what I gather were the moments of that, where we're seeing people saying, "What do you have that camera for?" And then things go black. But it's interesting, even though you were detained, you didn't ever make this film about you or about your crew. I mean, we see the moment before. Again, at least I gathered the moment before you were arrested, maybe not, but we don't see you talking about it. We don't get many details from that. I guess you just didn't want it to be about your experience. You wanted to keep it focused or something?
Well, I make films about characters that I follow, and it's not about me, and I wanted to keep the film about them. Having said that, most, you know, everybody on this crew was very much a part of what was happening on the street. Everybody was either shot at, arrested, run after. So it wasn't really a crew you could hire. You can't ask you can't hire somebody to be in that situation. You can't put people in that situation. They have to be people that want to be there anyway, filming for their own purposes or as a protester, learning how to take sound. Our sound guys were two protesters that learned how to take sound. So really the crew came together among people that were going to be there anyway. The first time I was arrested was when I landed, actually, because I had wanted to make this film, and I was thinking about it when Tunisia exploded, and I wanted to be following what was happening on the ground in Egypt, because I knew that we were sort of on a exploding point. I didn't know when that would happen. So when these protests were planned for the 25th of January, I was also invited to go to Davos at the time, where all of the leadership of Egypt were going to be. So I thought that would be a very interesting place to be if Egypt exploded. So I took a flight out, actually, the day that protests started. And, of course, nobody showed up in Davos because the Egyptian leadership saw how huge this was going to be, and nobody came. So I had to get back to Egypt as quickly as I could. Of course, I had all my camera equipment with me, and I called friends of mine on the ground in Egypt, and they said, your camera equipment is probably going to be confiscated at the airport, so you'd better pick up on your way a Canon camera, which looks like a photography camera, but can be used as a video camera, because they won't confiscate the cameras that look like photography cameras. So I flew back to Cairo just as everybody said, my camera equipment got confiscated, and I was able to keep my my small Canon photography camera. Left the airport, stuff was confiscated at the airport. Left the airport, military had already taken over on the streets. There were tanks all around. And we were stopped at a few checkpoints. Probably the second checkpoint that we were stopped at, they asked for my passport. I gave both, I have an Egyptian and American passport, gave both passports. That somehow set off something, a kind of suspicion. Why was I coming in at this point in time? They searched the car, and in the car they found a film that I had made about, I had about 10 copies of a film I had made 3 years earlier called Egypt, We're Watching You, which was about three women activists who had been filming a lot of the corruption of the elections. And when the guy saw that, I wasn't sure if it registered, but I was pretty sure it had. He sort of saw it, you know, in my bag. Mm-hmm. But he basically gave the signal, take them in. So I wasn't sure whether it was my dual citizenship or these tapes that the CDs that they'd found. Taken in, questioned for about 4 hours, and not telling them. I didn't know who I was taken in by. It turned out that it was military intelligence. But I was fearful. I was, you know, I was still in that place that I had grown up in of, do not say what you do. Do not say that you're a filmmaker. Do not say that you've made any political films. And I was so scared when I was talking to them. And I managed to get into the car, shove a bunch of the DVDs like down a drain, because I knew that the next thing was that they were going to search the car completely. Went back into the to the questioning room, and about 20 minutes later, it was like the movies, you know, some guy who was cleaning the bathrooms walks in with this shard of a piece of one of the DVDs and holds it in the air in front of me. Wow. And I just broke, and I said, you know, look, I am a filmmaker. I made a film about three incredible Egyptian women who were fighting for their country. It's exactly what's happening now. And I was just completely honest about everything I felt about what was happening in the country. And this kind of, this fear just broke, because I was just saying, I'm going to say exactly what I think, and whatever happens to me, happens to me. And I think at that moment, I felt a small piece of what everybody in that square was feeling. This is enough. I'm just not going to hide how I feel anymore. They let me go about 2 hours later, and I was in the square and met this incredible group of people that ultimately became part of this film. So that for me was this sort of moment of change. And then the next time that we were arrested, I was with Megdi. It was the height of the battle. Megdi is the Muslim Brotherhood character in the film, and we got caught. There was a ceasefire between the protesters and the army and police, and so we were filming the ceasefire. And all of a sudden, a tear gas canister flies, a rock flies, and things explode again. And instead of running towards the protesters' side, we actually went to the army side and did a couple, actually, kind of funny, amazing interviews on the army side, because here were these army officers that looked like astronauts, because they were had all of this gear to protect them from tear gas and bulletproof vests and I don't know what. And he's trying to yell at me through his mask. I said, can I interview you? And he said, yeah, no problem. These protesters are attacking us. We're, you know, and here you have these like 18-year-old kids on the other side, you know, wearing absolutely nothing. And so we got that interview for a bit, and then I pushed it too far. I interviewed him for too long. And, you know, 10 minutes later, as we were walking out, somebody saw me. And it was pretty scary, actually, because he was wearing a, a ski mask, which was covering everything but his eyes. And he said to me, "You're Jahan." And I still to this day do not know how he knew who I was or what my name was. But, you know, then we were taken into the police cars and driven around in this big blue police car with about 30 guys. So Megdi, the Brotherhood character, was in one part of the car. I was in another part of the car with a metal sheet between us. Mm. And he talked me through this sort of 7 hours of driving around in a way that really got me through it. I mean, he was like singing songs and we're going to get through this. And so anyway, that was about 30 hours of being detained. And then we were let go. But the reason I think why I haven't concentrated on it in the film at all is because, you know, I feel like I'm a very lucky person to have gotten out of 24 hours. The people, or 36 hours or whatever it was, the people that that I was standing with and the people that are fighting on the front lines of this battle, if they got arrested, they're spending a much longer time in there. There's no articles coming out about them. They don't have an American passport. They don't have the U.S. embassy calling in to see if they can get them out. And so I feel like that, you know, it's very important to be covering the people on the ground who actually are putting much more at risk than myself and many of my team members were. So that's why we didn't go into that. But, you know, maybe in the deleted scenes or extra scenes or something.
The DVD extra. Jahan Nujaim is with us. She directed The Square. This coming Wednesday evening, we're presenting a free screening of the film at 7 o'clock. It's at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. Nujaim and producer Karim Amer will join us via Skype for a Q&A. It's all part of our Through the Lens documentary series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. For details about that, go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Jahan Nujaim. She's the director of the film The Square. It's the latest in our Through the Lens documentary series. We're screening it. It's your first chance to see it, by the way, since it premiered at Sundance. That's Wednesday night at 7. We'll give you the details about that a little bit later. You can just go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Jahan Nujaim is joining us from NPR West in Culver City. Well, you mentioned Magdi, and I have to say he was, if not my favorite, one of my favorite characters, and I wanted to talk about him because he is, as you said, he's the one who kind of represents the Muslim Brotherhood, but he's so conflicted. On one hand, he feels this kinship with his fellow protesters. He's gone to the square. He's there from the beginning. But then he's torn by his religious principles and his connection with the Muslim Brotherhood. And he's, I have to say, he's the most kind of conflicted character and one of the most interesting in the film. Talk about Magdi.
That's exactly right. I mean, he's somebody who was very torn and therefore becomes an interesting person to follow because he became very close to his secular friends. He believed very strongly in the values of the revolution, but he also has this 25-year loyalty to the Brotherhood and at a certain point felt like when the Brotherhood was threatened, Islam was being threatened. And, when the conflict for him gets to be the most intense is really when the Brotherhood, I mean, this is what he feels. He feels the Brotherhood represents Islam. And then he starts to change in the film because mm-hmm. he starts to see that the Brotherhood is actually working with the military and completely focused on elections when the revolutionaries that are still fighting for a constitution and still fighting for basic rights are being slaughtered in the streets by the military and the police. And so he basically says at a certain point in the film, forget the Brotherhood, I'm a revolutionary first. Mm-hmm. The film takes a number of twists and turns because we follow him over a course of 2.5 years. And later on in the film, when the Brotherhood is then massacred by the army. Yeah. And you see a scene at home with his family. His mother says, you know, these are the people that are, he has five kids. Who do you think is paying for these five kids? Who do you think is supporting us? So it's not only a loyalty to the Brotherhood, but it's also a financial obligation, because these are people that have been financially supporting him. Mm. And so he goes to the Brotherhood sit-in to basically protect the Brotherhood sit-in. But in the at the same time, he's incredibly conflicted because he's become very close with the secular revolutionaries that he fought with. We actually had a screening in Toronto. We were awarded the Audience Award in Toronto, and it was an incredibly moving moment when these Egyptians came up to us after the screening and said they were in tears and they wanted to speak to Megdi and they wanted to speak to Ahmed, because what you see on the news is that this country is so divided and that there's no hope now. Whereas what you see in the film is you see these friendships that have been built between people, and there is hope because these people who once fought together still have a friendship and still have a hope for their country together. And so we're trying to get the film back to Egypt as soon as possible, because I think that that message needs to be spread as widely across Egypt as we can.
Mm. There's a moment, I don't want to give too much away about the end, but there's a telephone conversation near the end between Magdi and Ahmed, which is one of the most powerful moments. It's you've got Magdi, who is there at the pro-Morsi sit-in, and there's all this violence going on, and Ahmed is feeling elated because because Morsi's gone now, that worked, you know, but he feels circumspect about all of that, and it's a really touching moment in the film.
Thank you. It's a moment that is, when we were watching it, we were incredibly torn and emotional about it, because it's, you know, it was Ahmed basically so excited, as you said, that they had removed Morsi. The 30th of June was something that has never happened, you know, in such a large way. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people came down on June 30th to say, you will not use religion to do exactly the same thing that our previous dictator has done. And that's how people felt on the street. People felt like Morsi was using religion in order to fool people into another dictatorship and doing the same kinds of things, changing the constitution, doing the same kinds of things that Mubarak had done. Mm-hmm. And worse, what really offended people were that people who were speaking on behalf of Morsi and in rallies where Morsi was present, saying these people, these protesters, the people that are coming down against Morsi are kafir, meaning like anti-religious, not Muslim. And they basically were saying, you know, nobody's going to say that I am not religious, I'm not Muslim, because I don't agree with Morsi. So when Morsi was actually removed, and of course, Ahmed, if you see him through the whole film, it's not ideal that the army had to remove him, but they had to remove him. And it was that moment where really there was a hopeful place where the army could have taken this. And I don't want to, you know, give away the end either, but I think, you know, very soon after, Ahmed feels incredibly torn because the military becomes violent with the Brotherhood in the same way that they were violent with the revolutionaries earlier on in the film.
You know, there's this huge moment of insight, at least for me, by Khalid Abdallah in the film, in this conversation he's having with his fellow revolutionaries. And he says, politics is not the same as revolution. In politics, you have to compromise. And it made me wonder, at what point does the idealism of any revolution have to settle in for those moments of compromise and moments of disappointment? What do you think you learned about the evolution of revolution in the film?
That's a very good question, and something that I was asking myself throughout. And revolution has been described by Khalid and others as being able to achieve a massive amount of change in a very short period of time. And when you no longer see that possibility, when you have a constitution in place, elected leaders in place, you're moving into the political sphere. Khaled and the other revolutionaries still believe that we are in this revolutionary moment. Mm. I think it's a very difficult thing to be able to see when we're actually moving to more of the political moment. And that does have to happen. I mean, right now, it's a very tumultuous time because we don't have the checks and balances. So if Morsi had done the same kinds of things that he did in the U.S. or in places where there is a constitution and there is a way to impeach a president, he may have been impeached. Mm. But there are no checks and balances in place yet. There is no constitution written yet. So the street is the ballot boxes, and is the ballot box in a way. So the revolution is continuing, and people are able to achieve this massive amount of change in this short period of time. And once a constitution is written, and once that constitution is accepted by the people and a leadership is elected, you move into more of a political time.
Let me ask you this finally, about 30 seconds left, less than a minute anyway. Ahmed says this remarkable thing at one moment in the film. He predicts the end of the Muslim Brotherhood, and this is before Morsi falls, and everyone else thinks...
This is a year before Morsi falls.
It's just an amazing moment, and everyone's like, you are crazy. And of course it happens, but he says this thing in that moment. He says, we're going to change the culture. I mean, he says the revolution is a culture of people. Do you think that they did that? Do you think the culture is now really transformed in Egypt?
I do. And I think you can see that with the kids on the street. He points out the kids on the street that are playing this game called, you know, revolutionary, and we demand the fall of the regime, and different people play Muslim Brotherhood and army. And I think that that is what has changed deeply in Egypt, is that people are questioning. And that is something that has been incredible to see.
Shahan Nujaim, director of The Square. On Wednesday, we're partnering with the Utah Film Center to present a free screening of the documentary as part of our Through the Lens series. Go to our website for the particulars. And Nujaim and Karim Amer will join us after the film for a
Skype. Could I say something about the Utah Film Center really quickly?
Yes.
Utah Film Center has saved our life, because with a film like this, you don't really know when you're going to end. So if you're funded by a television station or something, they're always forcing you to end it. Because people were able to make donations through the Utah Film Center, we were able to stay independent, and we were able to make the story that we did. So we are incredibly thankful for the Utah Film Center.
Great. Well, we like him too. Congratulations, Jahan Nujaim. We're glad you could be with us. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Radio West, production of KUER News. Our thanks to Anna Sprouse, Taylor Almond. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.